From Clearfield to Pittsburgh, Somerset to Beaver Falls, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, it has been 2 years since the landmark U.S. Supreme Court Janus ruling affirmed the right of workers not to be required to pay dues to a labor union. Nathan McGrath of the Fairness Center is here with an update. Counties and municipalities across Pennsylvania are dealing with a loss of tax revenue due to the COVID-19 spawned economic crisis. Eric Montardi and Hannah Bowser have an Allegheny Institute report. And a number of criminal justice reforms are moving through the Pennsylvania legislature. Ashley Klingensmith of Americans for Prosperity Pennsylvania has this week's Lincoln Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to Nathan McGrath at the Fairness Center in just a couple of minutes, but first, news headlines from patownhall.com. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court has decided to hear the dispute between Governor Tom Wolf and the Pennsylvania General Assembly over whether or not the legislature has the power to force an end to the governor's emergency declaration over the COVID-19 pandemic. Lawmakers over a week ago invoked a state law that allows them to require the governor to end such emergency declarations. Wolf maintains the statute is unconstitutional. Republicans had sought to have the case heard in the Commonwealth Court, which has more partisan balance than the Supreme Court, which is heavily dominated by Democrat justices who are seen as more likely to rule in the governor's favor. Pennsylvania House Speaker Michael Terzai officially resigned both his leadership post and his seat in the state house on Monday. Later in the week, revealed he has taken a job as general counsel for People's Gas. Terzai had represented a suburban Pittsburgh district since winning a special election in 2001. He had announced earlier this year that he would not seek re-election to his House seat and would be retiring. Terzai's early exit sets up the need for House members to elect a new speaker. State Representative Brian Cutler of Lancaster County is the House majority leader and is considered to be an early favorite to advance to the speaker's chair. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. 2 years ago, the Supreme Court of the United States issued a landmark ruling in Janus v. AFSCME that upheld the right of workers to hold a public sector job without being required to pay dues or other fees to a labor union. Enforcing that right, however, has been a challenge. To learn more, we turn to Nathan McGrath. Nathan is president and general counsel of the Fairness Center. Nathan, welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. Nathan, the landmark Janus v. AFSCME decision handed down by the United States Supreme Court just about 2 years ago. Before we get into talking about the impact of this and what has occurred since, can you give our listeners some background? Who was Mark Janus? What is the issue and what was the ruling?
Mark Janus was a public employee employed by the state of Illinois, and his case, basically what it was doing was it was challenging Illinois law that made it legal for a public employee union to take fees from him even though he was not a member of the union. And that law was basically green-lighted by a Supreme Court decision a long time ago, back in 1977, which was called Abood versus Detroit Board of Education. And that's where the Supreme Court first said, yeah, it's okay to take union fees from people, even if they're non-members. And so Mark wanted to challenge that. And he said, as a non-member, I'm not a member of the union. I don't agree with the union and its political speech. And I don't want to be forced to support that. So he filed a lawsuit, and it trickled all the way up through the district court and the Court of Appeals and up to the Supreme Court. And as you mentioned, about 2 years ago, the Supreme Court handed down its ruling in what we now call the Janus case. And the ruling was pretty simple. It just said public employees can't be forced to pay union fees as a condition of their employment if they're non-members. So that was the bottom line ruling in that case.
So now it is the law of the land that non-union members cannot be forced to pay dues to labor unions. Knowing how these things operate, I would assume that labor unions have not fallen all over themselves to accept this and have fought it in various ways. Can you give us some examples of how labor unions have tried to skirt the Janus decision?
Of course, you had the Supreme Court ruling, and then you have what we call the enforcement period. So we have to get everybody on the right page now with the Supreme Court. And I would say probably one of the biggest roadblocks for folks to claim their Janus rights is probably the membership issue. And so you may kind of wonder, what does membership have to do with that? Well, the whole point of claiming your Janus rights is if you're a non-member. And so I think what a lot of unions did after the Janus decision, they said, well, you know, before we didn't really care so much if they're members or non-members because we still took money from them. But now we can't take money from non-members. And so we're maybe going to make it a little bit more difficult to get out of the union. And here in Pennsylvania in particular, there's a law in the books that allows a union and the employer to negotiate into the contract what's called a maintenance and membership provision, which means we can hold you in for a certain period of time, basically against your will, until there's a small 15-day window period, typically a couple years down the road. And so what they did was they tried to enforce a lot of these maintenance and membership provisions, or resignation letters went unacted upon for months or lost or never responded to, all these types of things. And so people were still having to pay union dues because they were never recognized as a non-member, and therefore they couldn't claim their Janus rights. So that was, I would say, probably one of the biggest hurdles, and continues to be one of the biggest hurdles for people claiming their Janus rights.
In terms of Pennsylvania-based labor unions, have we seen a lot of instances of these type of activities, or have unions been more or less willing to just go along and not fight that fight?
It's depended on the union. Some unions pretty quickly put out letters and said, we're not going to collect money anymore. Janus has come down. It's over. And then other unions have really waited until folks like our clients sued them and pushed on them. And then they kind of begrudgingly let our clients out or gave them their money back. And actually, I'd say because in large part, because we've had a lot of clients and a lot of cases over this issue, some of the biggest labor unions here in Pennsylvania have actually taken the membership clause, the restrictions, out of their subsequent CBAs. So we estimate about 22,500 state employees now aren't subject to those types of membership restrictions here in Pennsylvania.
So progress is being made. We are talking with Nathan McGrath. He is with the Fairness Center, president and general counsel. We are talking about the landmark United States Supreme Court ruling Janus v. AFSCME relative to not forcing individuals who are members of labor unions to have to pay dues. You have individuals, Nathan, who had been paying dues to labor unions against their will for many, many years. Now you have the landmark Janus v. AFSCME decision. What about those past dues? Is it possible for employees to go back and get recompensated or get compensated for those dues?
Well, that's a really interesting question. And in fact, there's been a lot of litigation in the last 2 years surrounding folks who say, well, hey, you know, the Supreme Court just recognized my right as a non-member not to pay these the often called fair share fees or agency fees, those types of things. And so I shouldn't have been paying them all these years. And so I'm actually going to sue to go back a number of years and try to recover all of that money. And I would say that largely, at least at the lower courts, that argument has been relatively unsuccessful. The courts have sided with the unions frequently, citing what they believe to be a good faith exception, saying, well, there is a Supreme Court ruling for all these years, and the union acted in good faith to take these fees from these non-members. And so even though these non-members, you know, it's now known that they have this constitutional right not to pay, we're not going to allow them to go back and reclaim their money that they shouldn't have had to pay in years past. And that's actually interesting. As we come up on the 2-year mark of the first Janus decision, the Supreme Court is actually considering whether to take the second Janus case, which is Mark Janus then brought his case to do exactly what you're saying, to go back and to get his fees back. And so we'll know very soon, probably, whether the Supreme Court wants to take up that question or not, where there has been a lot of courts around the country now that have been grappling with that exact question.
The cases that have had to be brought against labor unions who were not upholding the Janus rights of their members, can you cite any specific case that your law center has been involved in, the Fairness Center has been involved in, to try to enforce those rights?
One of the ones that's still ongoing and that I think is actually really interesting, in fact, our client's case is in front of the Third Circuit right now. Once the Janus ruling came down, they decided they wanted their case to basically bring Janus to Pennsylvania because Pennsylvania still has the fair share fee law on the book, which under Janus now is unconstitutional. And so they said, you know, we need to not have outdated laws on the book here in Pennsylvania. We want a court to strike down this unconstitutional law. And so they've continued with that case. It's in front of the Third Circuit right now. But interestingly, and we filed this before the case, PSEA, which is the Pennsylvania State Education Association, and the local teacher unions, they've continued to negotiate fair share fee provisions into CBAs that were then agreed to after Janus. And so that's been like some of the examples where our clients have been like, hey, hold up here. Look, they're still acting under unconstitutional law. Now, admittedly, that we know of anyway, PSEA and its locals haven't been collecting money under those provisions, but they've still been putting unconstitutional language in these CBAs signed after Janus. And so that's one of the cases that our clients have going right now to really, again, bring Janus here to Pennsylvania.
Now that the Supreme Court has issued this ruling, and even though we are 2 years later, Nathan, do employees really know that they have this right? Are they required by their employer or by their labor union to be notified of their Janus rights?
Yeah, no, a lot of them, in fact, don't know of this right. Actually, we had one of our clients testify up here at the state capitol in Harrisburg to a committee, legislative committee, talking about how in his workplace, nobody's heard of Janus. Nobody knows that they have the right not to join a union and not have to pay. And why he was testifying was because there have been over the last couple sessions, a couple different bills dealing with membership, like I was talking about earlier, saying that you can't force someone to be in a union past the time that they want to be. There's also legislation, notice requirements that the employer would have to tell a new employee that, hey, you have the right not to be part of a union and you have the right as a non-member not to pay any fees to the union. So there are some legislative efforts going on so that employees would be made aware of their rights. But I'd say by and large, unless you're kind of involved in these issues, a lot of people don't know about the Janus decision or the effect it could have on their life.
We have been talking with Nathan McGrath, who is president and general counsel of the Fairness Center. Nathan, tell us a little bit about the Fairness Center. Also, where can folks go on the web to learn more?
The Fairness Center is a nonprofit public interest law firm, and we love to offer free legal services to those who have been hurt by public sector union officials. We've represented everyone from union members, union non-members, teachers. We've represented even a local union before. And we can be found on the web at fairnesscenter.org. Go there and you can see more of our work, our cases, and even get in touch with us if you want to.
Nathan McGrath of the Fairness Center. Nathan, thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
The COVID-19 economic shutdown has had a significant impact on county and municipal budgets. To see how some counties are dealing with the problem, Eric Montardi talks with Hannah Bowser on this Allegheny Institute report.
Hello, and welcome to the Allegheny Institute report on the Lincoln Institute Radio Journal. I'm Eric Montardi. Joining me today is Hannah Bowser, research assistant with the Allegheny Institute. Hannah, how are you today?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
I'm doing great, Hannah. Thank you very much. In the past couple weeks here, the Allegheny Institute has done a lot of work on estimating the various impacts on local governments from the city of Pittsburgh to Allegheny County to the Turnpike, to the Port Authority, and your most recent brief looked at the six other counties in the Pittsburgh metro area, and there we're talking Westmoreland, Washington, Butler, Beaver, Fayette, and Armstrong counties. And wanted to get an idea of what's happening with the primary funding sources for those counties and what type of actions they've taken recently. So, Hannah, can you give our listeners an idea? What is the primary local revenue source for the counties, for the ones outside of Allegheny County? And can you give our listeners an idea if those counties took any specific actions with regard to the revenue source as a result of the coronavirus?
The primary source of local revenue for these counties is property taxes, and unlike Allegheny County, which levies a sales and use tax, these six counties mentioned in the brief don't levy this type of tax. So most of their general fund revenue is coming from property tax collections. So for example, with the counties that we examined, property taxes, a portion of general fund revenues, ranged anywhere from about 46% on the low side in Washington County up to 74% in Butler County. Now, in response to your second question on whether these counties took any specific actions in regard to this revenue source, five of the six counties actually opted to extend their property tax payment deadlines. Some prolonged it for only a few months, while others actually extended it until the end of the year.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's something we've seen that's been quite common, because obviously with most property tax payments, you'll have a discount period, then you'll have a face period, and then you get to a date where anything's paid beyond or after that certain date, then it goes to delinquent and there's a penalty and interest placed upon it. So from Allegheny County and some of the other municipalities, and then as you mentioned, with five of these counties in the metro area, that they've pushed those deadlines back. So it basically is giving people more time to pay their property taxes. And, you know, property taxes are relatively, you know, compared to sales and use or income taxes are, you know, much more stable. So we'll see over the next couple months with the periods being extended, how that does for the collections and how it compares to last year, 2019, for these counties. Let's talk a little bit about the spending side, because obviously local government is a very personnel driven enterprise. It's when you look at a pie chart of a budget, most of it is salaries, wages, and benefits. So have these counties done anything specifically with their personnel? And if they did, what did they do?
While Allegheny County, the city of Pittsburgh, and other large county authorities decided not to furlough, several of the counties we examined did furlough. Of the ones that did, anywhere from about 20 to 30% of employees were furloughed. Now, in Westmoreland, some of those workers have actually been recalled, so it remains to be seen if other counties will follow a similar pattern or not.
Yes, that's interesting. And again, yeah, it could be something where it might be things go back, and now, you know, we're talking most of these counties are now in, you know, the green phase of the reopening. That's possible that a lot of these workers could be called back. Hannah, let's talk a much bigger issue, because obviously we're focused on local government. And, you know, property taxes being a local revenue, and then personnel, and that's a local decision by county elected officials as to enact furloughs. There's obviously a lot of money that's been floating around from the CARES Act, which was passed in late March by the federal government. One of the things that it did was it set up a $150 billion coronavirus relief fund, and that money went to the 50 states. It also went to local governments of a certain population size, and that was defined as being as 500,000 people or more. So that essentially covered seven counties in Pennsylvania. We have 67 counties in Pennsylvania. So is there anything that has been done as of late that would affect these six counties and then the other counties across Pennsylvania that did not get direct funding from the CARES Act?
In late May, the Pennsylvania legislature passed Act 24, which allocates $2.6 billion of this $3.9 billion. And part of this money, $625 million, will be distributed to the remaining 60 counties that did not meet CARES Act population requirements and thus were not previously eligible for federal stimulus money. This means that the six counties in the metro area and other counties across the state that did not receive the money directly will receive funding through Act 24. And now, according to a House fiscal note on the legislation, counties will receive funding, quote, on or before July 15th, 2020, and no county shall receive a distribution less than $1 million, end quote. So of the counties we examined, the amount of money to be received ranges from $11.6 million in Fayette to $31.5 million in Westmoreland. But the Act also lists specific purposes that the money can be used for, which includes aspects such as business aid, assistance to local government entities, and help for nonprofits. Revenue replacement, however, was not one of the allowable uses. So how exactly these counties will allocate the funding remains to be seen still.
That's a good point, because I know that when they originally passed that piece of legislation and the money was sent to Pennsylvania and then specifically said that these seven counties would get money, that they said one of the things that can't be done is it just can't plug a revenue hole. Obviously, those other uses, that's going to be something that it's going to be incumbent upon the state government and then I guess ultimately the federal government to make sure that, you know, when the money gets distributed, that it's used for those purposes and not for anything else. I mean, that's basically, you know, that then comes from, you know, like an auditing function after that happens. Because I think, correct me if I'm wrong, like the money basically had to account for something that was not budgeted for. Is that right? Like this is basically to respond to what happened from the coronavirus pandemic.
Exactly. I believe it has to, the expense has to be for something between March 1st and December of this year. So it has to be related to expenditure from the virus, yes.
Right. And, and then with most of these counties then budgeting on a calendar year, they had their budget set in late December, started their fiscal year January 1st. And now they're almost at the midpoint. And then we'll see, like you said, where, you know, how this money gets used and how it's utilized. Hannah, I want to thank you very much for sharing this research with our listeners. As always, we encourage you to visit our website, which is www.alleghenyinstitute.org. You can read this brief. You can read our archives. You can follow us on Twitter. For Hannah Bowser, this is Eric Montardi, and this has been the Allegheny Institute Report on the Lincoln Institute Radio Journal.
Americans for Prosperity has been pushing for criminal justice reform, and now legislation is starting to move through the Pennsylvania General Assembly. Ashley Klingensmith from Americans for Prosperity Pennsylvania has details on this Lincoln Radio Journal commentary.
As protests began across the nation following the death of Mr. George Floyd last month, conversations around many kitchen tables also began about the challenges and potential solutions that could address some of the issues that have compromised community trust and collaboration with police. Law enforcement need communities, and communities need law enforcement. When we contemplate the principle of mutual benefit, we know there's work to be done to ensure we're putting forth the right incentives for police and the communities they serve to motivate them to assist rather than harm one another. Continuous improvement to society's key institution of government is critical, and this is something AFP works on daily. This ideal of continuous improvement extends across all sectors of government, and that includes our police. They play a critical role. Every day they are tasked with keeping our communities safe, which routinely places them in harm's way. Effectively maintaining public safety and order begins with policing practices that build trust and collaboration. Trust can grow when police act as peace officers and focus resources on preventing and solving serious crime. That's why AFP is engaged at all levels to advance three core areas of criminal justice reform. And while these aren't new issues for our organization, they do have a renewed sense of importance and urgency. First, transforming police culture to prioritize transparency and accountability with the public. The vast majority of police officers across the country know that policies around use of force must change. They are also rightly frustrated that many police union agreements protect bad actors from facing the consequences of their decisions. We can address recruitment practices, training, tactics, and union contract reform. Second, reforming bad incentives such as civil asset forfeiture and qualified immunity. which is a judge-made law that prevents law enforcement officers who violate people's constitutional rights from being held accountable for their actions. Structural barriers to good policing can be addressed. And we also can elevate alternative measures of success, like community engagement and public safety. Third, eliminating unnecessary overcriminalization. State criminal laws should be limited to the rightful role of the state. All laws should distinguish between intentional acts, reckless acts, and accidents. We've criminalized things like poverty, addiction, mental health, and other issues. Over the past 40 years, we've added 300,000 federal crimes to the enforcement burden that officers must carry. We should be focused on bringing them back to their core functions of protecting people and preserving public safety. You know, Harrisburg has heard and has taken actionable steps toward effectuating meaningful reform. Last spring, 19 bills were introduced that are related to police accountability. And just last Monday, the House Judiciary Committee voted out two of those bills, amending two others into them. So four of the 19 were addressed. This legislation would improve the transparency of accountability of law enforcement while maintaining reasonable privacy protections for them by storing police disciplinary records in a state database. It would also require PA law enforcement agencies to review the disciplinary files of former law enforcement officers prior to making hiring decisions. We rightly expect the highest standards from our public servants wielding the great powers accompanying the responsibility for our safety. Police officers who commit misconduct should not be rehired as officers elsewhere simply because departments are unaware of their previous history. Community trust can grow when police act as peace officers. Joint hearings between the Senate Judiciary and Senate Law and Justice Committees were also heard last week. How we collectively respond to the tragedy in Minneapolis and others will determine whether we move closer to the ideals that inspired our nation's founding: freedom, equal rights, and a deep belief that every person can contribute and succeed.
That's Ashley Klingensmith from Americans for Prosperity. If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, LincolnRadioJournal.com and LincolnInstitute.org. For 25 years, Lincoln Radio Journal has been heard on public affairs-minded radio stations throughout the Commonwealth, including WKQL-FM in Punxsutawney, WIOV-AM in Reading, along with WIYQ-AM and FM in Saxonburg, Pennsylvania. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, and the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, all of whom have helped to underwrite the costs of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Lincoln Broadcast Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal, plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania.